We have all new information this hour about a shocking murder case. A boy who's just 12 years old just appeared in court for charges for a 92-year-old woman's murder. We have learned that boy's name is Harold Pinckney Jr. We are running his name because he's facing a charge of murder. Lane County Sheriff's deputies say he killed 92-year-old Irma Burnell inside her Cresswell home. That's about 15 miles from Eugene. Her neighbor went to check in on Burnell Monday afternoon and found her brutally murdered. Deputies have not yet said what led up to the 12-year-old boy's arrest or whether he knew Burnell. He appeared in front of a judge this morning wearing a white sweatshirt, blue pants, and Nikes. His lawyer said he denies the charges against him. Pinckney's mother also spoke in court. She says she told the judge that her son had mental health issues for years and she's tried to get help but didn't get it. She said this could have been prevented if she was offered the services she requested. We'll, of course, continue to follow the story and we'll bring you updates just as soon as they come into the newsroom.
Good evening and welcome to Season 2 of Death Mysteries. I'm your host, Kingman Bond Graham, and tonight we're going to visit a county just north of me called Lane County. It is the second largest urban area in the state of Oregon. It is home to a couple of cities called Springfield and Eugene, which are really close to each other. They're kind of twin cities. And Oregon State University is there. There's lots of hippies. There's lots of good vibes. But there's also a darker side to the Springfield-Eugene area. There's a lot of cold cases, a lot of missing people. In fact, there was a very famous missing person case. Michael Bryson, who went missing at Hobo Creek Campground earlier this summer, kind of brought my attention to Lane County, and it brought the attention of the whole state of Oregon and perhaps the nation. And that is still an unsolved case. The clip we just listened to is really shocking to me because a 12-year-old boy murders a 92-year-old woman. Now, I don't believe this case has actually gone to trial yet, and because of COVID, it may not be resolved for quite some time. And we're going to keep up on that, and I'll probably go over a few details of that case during this podcast, but I really, really want to go over Lane County's top cold cases, and there is actually one in particular that has a lot of newspaper articles about it, but stay tuned. We're going to cover Lane County tonight, and it'll probably be a one-part episode, but it'll probably be longer. I'm going to start trying to do episodes that last about an hour, 30-something minutes. That might not quite be enough, but yeah, I really appreciate all my listeners. I really appreciate everybody who's come back and listened over and over. I look at my analytics. I get a little bit over 100 people every single episode. Might not be that many. Might not be what I really want, but I'm flattered every single person that is taking the time to listen to my podcast. Again, I'm still looking for a co-host. If you want to, be a partner in crime with me, get in contact with me. And don't forget to check out my YouTube, Death Mysteries, on YouTube. And you can email me at Death Mysteries Podcast if you have a deathmysteriespodcast@gmail.com. If you have a case that you want me to cover, and we're going to continue to stay in the state of Oregon through season two, and then we're going to go to Washington State. Anyway, lots of research, lots of good stuff. Turn off the lights. My lights are already off. I'm in my basement. It's cold. It's dark. I think I hear some weird noises. And get ready for some death mysteries. Okay, guys, are you ready for another episode? Well, you must be because you're here and you're listening, right? I hope you're listening in the dark, but if not, a good time to listen is when you're doing yard work or maybe some dishes or some laundry or cleaning up evidence from your latest kill. I don't know. So we opened up the episode with a news clip, which happened, it's about a story that happened in 2019. And this is a 12-year-old boy who murdered a 92-year-old woman. And I want to say that he is innocent until proven guilty. So when we say things like he murdered her, it hasn't been proven in a court of law yet. One thing that I did want to really hit on and reiterate from that news clip is that his mother had tried to get mental health assistance for this boy for some time, for a number of years. And she obviously saw the warning signs in her own child that he was going to become violent and was already violent. And a lot of times when we have young killers and adult killers, they show signs early on, antisocial signs, torturing animals. That's a big one, torturing animals. Anybody who takes joy in killing an animal, that's a really big red flag. And anybody who can't get along with other people for whatever reason and looks for conflict doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be a killer, but it also means that they have antisocial behaviors. And we all know that one person who is extremely violent, at least, well, one person. I've known quite a few people in my lifetime that are extremely violent, and they are definitely the type of people who could maybe fly off the handle and commit a murder. And I'm looking at some of the news articles about this, and it seems that the kid, if he is guilty, entered this woman's home with the intent to commit a burglary. She surprised him, and he ended up killing her. The victim's name in this case is Irma Burnell, and I really like the name Irma. That's cool. That's old-fashioned. You know, maybe if you're going to have a kid, name them Irma instead of Riley or Madison or something like that. Irma's cool. You know, we don't have too many Irmas around anymore. So, it seems that, you know, this is going to be one of those cases that's going to play out over the next couple of years. And this kid, being 12, he may or may not get out of prison. He may end up in the juvenile justice system and be released at 21 or 24 and be somebody that we're going to have to live with out in society later on. Could this kid be rehabilitated? I think there's a good chance that through therapy and maybe... Well, I'm not really, you know, an expert on criminal rehabilitation, but I always like to think there's hope for most criminals to change their ways. Most people aren't inherently bad. We all know that there are people who are constitutionally incapable of caring about other people because of their biological makeup, their mental wiring, and there are really dangerous people out there that are child molesters or murderers who really don't belong in society, but that is the exception to the rule. Most people who commit violent crimes and most people who commit nonviolent crimes stand a very good chance of being rehabilitated if our criminal justice system would actually focus on rehabilitation versus incarceration and punishment. Not to say that incarceration and punishment don't have their place, but if we followed a model such as they do in Japan and some of the European countries, and mind you, these are very different societies than ours, but if we took what works as far as rehabilitation and implemented that in our society, I think we could go a lot further in reintroducing people like this 12-year-old kid back to society when they are a young adult without more trauma from being wrapped up in the justice system. Because the way I see it, this kid may enter the juvenile justice system and then go on to be in the adult penal system and probably suffer more abuse, more violence, and learn how to be a more violent, more vicious criminal and come out maybe even more dangerous. Let's hope that doesn't happen. Someday, maybe I'll talk about San Quentin. I actually have some pretty in-depth inside knowledge into San Quentin and the programs that they have at that prison in California. And it really does focus on rehabilitation. And it has some of the worst offenders. And a lot of them come out and never reoffend and rejoin society. But that's a side topic. So we're going to talk about cold cases tonight. And I'm going to go through a couple that are listed as the top priority for the Lane County Sheriff's Office. And we're going to get started with one of my favorite murders from that area, if I can have a favorite murder. And what makes this case one of my favorites to research in Lane County is the fact that I found 5 newspaper articles dating over a couple of years in the 70s and even a few more recent articles. And there's also some pictures of the crime scenes. There's a map of where the primary crime scene was and the secondary crime scene and how close in proximity to each other they are. There's a lot of details. And just like every case that I've looked at with a lot of newspaper articles, the story changes actually a little bit from when it first happened to current day. And this is probably all details that are either worked out over time or lost in translation, but I'm going to tell the story as best I can. In the early morning hours of January 21st, 1970, the fire department in Junction City, Oregon, received a phone call that a vehicle parked in a trailer park inside a carport was on fire, and witnesses said there was a woman trapped underneath this vehicle. Before the fire department could respond to the scene, the vehicle actually exploded. And so it's not known if the female victim was dead before the fire was lit, died from the explosion, died from the fire, but she was pronounced dead on the scene. About 11 a.m. later that morning, the cries of a baby could be heard coming from an apartment just up the road from the scene where the burning vehicle was found. And entry was made into this apartment, and they found the baby okay, but they found a deceased man inside the apartment, and he had died from a large caliber gunshot wound to the head. As police started talking to the neighbors of this apartment, they determined that a woman was seen screaming at about 4:20, 4:30 in the morning, being dragged out of that apartment by a man into the street. This man actually interacted with 2 different neighbors. So we actually have 2 different eyewitnesses to this crime, a Jake Wacker and Don Bodker. They both talked to the police, and what they had to say was pretty chilling, actually. They both were awakened to screams. They came out of their apartments to see what was going on. This man was dragging the victim, who we now know was Julie Dade, and she was the female found underneath this burning station wagon. And when they confronted this man, he said, "Oh, don't worry, go back inside, she's just drunk." And after he threw her in her vehicle, she stopped screaming. He proceeded to take a flashlight out and search the street, and then he got in the car and drove off with the woman, Julie Dade. The vehicle that Julie Dade was put in was a 1962 Buick station wagon, and it's the same vehicle she would later be found dead underneath, parked in this trailer park. Curiously, about 20 minutes after the man drove off in the station wagon with Julie, he returned on foot with a flashlight and continued searching in the street. And he must have found what he was looking for, because police, later that morning, when they had daylight, they knew they had a crime scene, they really did a good job of looking over the area, and they didn't find anything in the street. This man dropped his wallet or keys or something else, money. It's still unknown why he targeted Julie and her husband. It's still unknown why he was there. But the returning with a flashlight, that takes a lot of guts, especially because I assume he had driven about 2 blocks away, parked the station wagon at this trailer park, put Julie underneath it, lit it on fire, and then come back on foot. I mean, that takes some guts, and it must have been pretty important, whatever he dropped the street, for him to come back right after this. Wacker and Bodkin actually gave a description of the man. They said he was a white male, medium height, whatever that means, you know, probably 5'9", 5'10". He was husky, he had a really bulky jacket on, and he had basically tucked his trousers, they said trousers in the article, he put his he tucked his pants in his boot. Who knows why he did that? Anybody from cow country knows that a lot of cowboys and a lot of people who work on ranches tuck their tuck their Wranglers into their boots. And I do this when I'm cleaning up sheep shit and horse shit and working in the mud, because I'd rather get my boots a little bit muddier than have to wash my pants over and over by getting shit on them. So when investigators went back to the Maple Street apartment and found the infant crying and Harry, Julie's husband, dead from a gunshot wound inside the apartment, they started to put two and two together, and they knew this was a married couple, and they were actually able to ID them at this point. Julie was only 20 years old, and Terry was only 22 years old when they were killed. I am not able to determine what happened to their young son. I believe he was literally under a year old when his parents were brutally murdered. I can only imagine that he was probably given, taken into custody by the grandparents. Maybe Julie or Terry's parents took custody of the child, or worst case scenario, this infant entered the foster care system. So I actually discovered a twist in this by reading multiple articles. The white station wagon that she was found underneath the 1962 Buick actually belonged to a man named Ferris Norman, and he lived at the trailer where the car was parked. So I don't think it was the same white station wagon that she was put in and driven away in. If it was, I mean, the suspect would have had to have stolen or known Mr. Ferris, used the vehicle, brought it back there, parked it, and put her underneath it. Or possibly he was driving just another white station wagon, saw a white station wagon, put her underneath it in this carport for unknown reasons, and put her on fire. It's pretty much a mystery. So Mr. Ferris Norman, and that's a really cool name, Ferris. Remember Ferris Bueller? So he actually went outside when he noticed the fire in the early morning hours, just before 5 a.m., and he took a fire extinguisher, he tried to put it out, but he couldn't, and like I said, it ended up exploding. Who knows what kind of evidence was lost due to the fire? And we know from a past Death Mysteries, where I talked about Dead Indian Road and the fires that were set up there and the murders that happened up there, and there's a lot of murders where basically the culprit, the evil person who kills somebody else, they decide, hey, I'm going to try to obliterate evidence by setting a fire. It doesn't always work out. Sometimes they set a fire and the fire doesn't burn up the body or the evidence like they want it to, and it actually draws attention to the crime scene. And other times they're very successful. Remember that movie She-Witch with Roseanne Barr? I think it was She-Witch, where she actually puts a bunch of spray paint cans and shit like that in the microwave and turns the gas on and blows her house up because her husband's been cheating on her, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, that comes to mind. Sometimes they're really successful in blowing up a house or blowing up a vehicle and burning it up, and all the evidence is lost. And other times it's not lost. But in this case, who knows what kind of evidence was lost in the fire and explosion. But we did have a pretty pristine crime scene back at the Maple Street apartment where Terry was shot in the head. And I do believe they recovered one bullet. I don't know if they recovered a cartridge. It could have been from a revolver. The police didn't really release details on this, and I haven't submitted a FOIA request to see if I can get a hold of the original police reports. But I'm assuming that they know what kind of weapon they're looking for, and they could run ballistics on it if a weapon was ever recovered. I do find it curious, too, looking at the original articles back from 1971 and 1970. The couple is referred to as Mr. and Mrs. Terry Dade, and Julie's name is rarely mentioned early on. And I think this really shows how far our country, or how much we've changed. When we used to refer to women as Mrs. Terry Dade and not by her first name, and kind of, couples were one entity back in the day, and we've really kind of separated that out now and made it so that women are really seen as, why wouldn't it be, guess what I'm trying to say here, why wouldn't he be Mr. Julie Dade? I don't know. That's just weird. Anyway, so I'm looking at the original crime scene photographs from 1970, and I see police standing in front of the apartment. It was a middle unit on the bottom floor of a apartment building, and the carport. I actually have photos of the carport and the burned station wagon, and they're in black and white. And so these are photocopies of old newspaper articles. So they're not really high resolution, but I do get a sense of exactly how the investigation was going. In that they cordoned it off, police stood around, and you've got uniformed cops, you've got plainclothes detectives, and possibly crime investigators, maybe even the DA standing there, just sort of looking and talking. And I think they were there for many hours, you know, combing the scene. And I know if you've watched CSI or any of the, you know, modern crime shows, they use all this technology and they use all this, you know, kind of, they've got a whole team of people there working tirelessly to solve these crimes. And it looks like they did have a whole team there that was really trying their best to get some leads on this, but they didn't have the technology back then. And who knows what kind of DNA may have been lost, you know, from the fire, not collected because it was 1970. You know, who knows what's in their evidence locker? Like I said, I don't even know what caliber. They just said large caliber. I don't even know what caliber, the rifle or the handgun, if it was a revolver. Who knows? But they did say large caliber. And we don't know if they recovered other, you know, key evidence at the crime scene. This is one they put a lot of information out there, but they're also holding back a lot of stuff. And we see this in a lot of investigations where the police department and the district attorney hold back information from the public, stuff that could help them develop a case against a person of interest or later on a suspect. Now, what's the difference between a person of interest and a suspect? Well, I always like to say a suspect is we've got a pretty good idea this person did it. A person of interest, there could be lots of people of interest, and it's just people that had motives, people that were in the area, people that are, you know, it's way before they're a suspect. It's just, we're kind of interested. Let's look at this person. And if they look at you and they say, okay, it looks good, like this person probably did this, then you become a suspect, just in case you're curious. So an article I found about the Dade's murder that was published a little bit after the first one back in 1970 has a little bit more information that released by the sheriff's department and by the district attorney. And it turns out that Julie Dade was killed by strangulation and by blows to the head. And the autopsy revealed that she was indeed deceased before being placed underneath that white station wagon and being lit on fire. So after the autopsy, they went over the crime scene and went over the Buick station wagon with a fine-tooth comb. And they determined that the gas tank was actually punctured with a screwdriver or an instrument similar to a screwdriver, which allowed the gas to flow out and be lit on fire. So when I look at the map of this crime, it shows that the trailer park is close to Maple Street Apartments. And indeed, it's about 1/2 mile straight down Prairie Road, which is also known as Highway 99 South. I live right off of Highway 99. This is Highway 99. You know, about 130 miles north of me, but it's the same highway I live off of. Also in this article, they mention that the Dades resided in Unit 11 at the Maple Street Apartment, and I can probably make some time in the next month or so to get up to Eugene, Springfield, Junction City area and make a video of the trailer park, maybe even find the trailer carport area where Julie's body was discovered underneath that station wagon and look at the Maple Street Apartments, go up to Unit 11, try not to act like a total creepazoid, and get some footage for my Death Mysteries YouTube channel. Okay, so there's actually another plot twist here. When an autopsy was done on Terry Dade, it was determined that he wasn't actually shot in the head, that there was no gun involved in this crime. He was killed by either blunt force trauma or sharp force, blunt force trauma to the head, maybe even with the same object that was used to puncture the gas tank on the station wagon. It also comes out that at about 4:30 in the morning, just moments after Julie was dragged out of her house and thrown into the station wagon, probably not the same station wagon, like I said, that she had actually jumped out of the car and ran over to a nearby home near the trailer park, maybe even in the trailer park, not quite clear, and banged on somebody's door, and they didn't answer the door. And it's assumed that her killer recaptured her and murdered her just moments after that. Maybe it's a good thing they didn't answer the door because they didn't become a death mystery murder victim. Or maybe they could have helped her. You know, I've gone over this before. If somebody is banging on my door in the middle of the night and I live out in the country, way up a dirt driveway, not dirt, it's road base. But anyway, way up a driveway, if somebody's banging on my door, I'm not going to answer the door unarmed. But who knows? This is in the city, so maybe they would have answered the door in their nightrobe and become a murder victim themselves. We'll never know. On Wednesday afternoon after the murders, police actually went out and they pulled over everybody they could find driving white station wagons to question. And they didn't develop any suspects by doing this. Everybody was cleared. So I was wondering what happened to their son. Their son was actually named Mark, and he was taken into police custody, and one of the officers who responded to the scene, his wife, actually took care of the baby for a couple of days until the child, Mark, could be turned over to Julie's parents. And as far as I know, they raised him, took custody of him, and I can only imagine what you would tell the kid as he grew up, because he had turned 1 year old just a day before the murder. I can only imagine what you would tell the kid as you were raising him about his murdered parents and the pain that they would feel from having their daughter and their son-in-law murdered and having to raise a kid, because they'd already raised their kids and now they were back being parents once again to a one-year-old. Just a tragedy all around. So a little bit more about the victims. Julie Dade had graduated high school in 1967, and she had graduated with honors, and she'd gone on to be a stay-at-home mom for Mark, and Terry was the breadwinner. And this sounds very Americana, very quaint 1960s, 1970s nuclear family, and a nuclear family cut short by a terrible event. But it said that she was completely dedicated to raising her son. She wasn't working at the time, which is good for her, you know. I would hope that, you know, the two-parent household with one parent being able to stay home with the kids, especially when they're young, I applaud that. By all reports, Terry Dade was not mixed up in any type of drugs or gambling or anything like that. So the motive to this crime is very, very perplexing. And the next fact that I'm gonna relay to you actually kind of hits home for me. Terry was born and raised in Junction City, and at the time of his death, he was working for the American-Canadian Lumber Mill in Junction City, making plywood. So just he had the exact same profession that I now have. He worked in a plywood. So this is one of those coincidences that just kind of goes, okay, now this guy was just working to make a living, doing the exact same type of job that I do today. Oh, and it even mentions that he was employed working the swing shift, the 3 to 11 p.m. So I work the 11 to 7 a.m. When I go in tonight, I take over to the swing shift, and I get there a few minutes early. Yeah, so at least he didn't have to work graveyard. He was working swing shift. God, this story has been a lot to research. There's more out there, but I think I covered the fine details of it and gave you an idea of just who Terry and Julie were, what happened to them. And again, we're looking for a husky 5'11", 5'9" man, Caucasian, who had his Wranglers tucked into his boots. That's about all we got. And this was 50 years ago. So this is one that may remain unsolved, unless there's some kind of DNA that's developed. Again, we don't have ballistics because it turns out that one of them were shot. I don't know what kind of evidence they have, the Lane County Sheriff's Department has in their evidence locker. But again, there are detectives still working this case all the way 50 years later. If you happen to have any information regarding the Dades homicide, you can call the Lane County Cold Case Unit at 541-682-4513. You can remain anonymous, and it's doubtful that anybody listening to this would have any information, but you never know, and that's why we put it out there. I'd like to add that this is one of those cases that likely wouldn't have gone unsolved in today's current world because there would have been more surveillance video, cell phones, a lot more evidence, but that's the way things go. All right, I'd like to give you guys an update on the Michael Bryson case. And I mentioned it earlier, there is actually a podcast by Amanda Papineau, which is all about Michael's disappearance. And it's entitled Nowhere to Be Found. It's actually a fascinating listen. Another source of information on Michael Bryson's disappearance is the Facebook group that his parents and family started called Let's Find Michael Bryson. It's got over 20,000 members on it. And they have been searching tirelessly in the woods. I mean, we have thousands of people out looking for Michael. And I'll refresh you on what happened last summer. He was at a rave in the woods at Hobo Creek Campground, and that's outside of Eugene, and he mysteriously disappeared. If you want to know more about it, I definitely suggest that you read on his Facebook page and listen to the podcast. But gosh, so they haven't found him. They haven't stopped looking. There's daily posts. There's all kinds of crazy theories about what might have happened to him. A lot of the people who were supposedly his friends at this rave are not talking. They're lying to investigators. They have convoluted stories. There's a lot of hinkiness going on. We could do an entire, you know, hour, 2 hour podcast on Michael Bryson, but we're not going to because we don't want to step on anybody's toes. And there's a lot of information out there, and I don't feel like I need to cover it because, well, a lot of other people are, and I'm just talking about it briefly here, giving you guys the information about where the Facebook group and the other podcast, and there's a lot of newspaper articles out there, but gosh, did he walk away on his own? Was he really, really high on drugs and wandered off into the woods? Was he a victim of foul play? We don't know yet, and this is a cold case that isn't quite too cold yet because it hasn't even been a year since he disappeared, but we really hope Michael's found and maybe even found alive. Maybe he had a psychotic break and he's somewhere around Portland, homeless, spanging, you know, trying to get more drugs. Who knows? On July 20th, 1975, an unidentified unsub, as they would call him on Criminal Minds, entered the Gentleman's Retreat Massage Parlor on River Road in Eugene, Oregon. And we all know, well, maybe not all of us, but when we hear massage parlor, we think of a front for maybe a prostitution ring. There's no evidence that that's what this place was operating at. But anyway, so this unknown man walks in and he takes Shirley Wallace and another unnamed female employee hostage at gunpoint. He takes them both to the back room where he binds their hands together and separates them from one another. The man takes Shirley to the back room where he commences sexually assaulting her, and the other woman, who is still unnamed, probably to protect her identity, is able to free herself and runs outside to a neighboring bar and alerts the patrons inside the bar. So at this point, it's about 11:30 p.m., and I should mention the bar's name is the Office 290. When I'm up in Eugene, I'm going to go see if I can find this massage parlor and the Office 290 bar and see if it's still in business and kind of walk around the area and maybe take some video. So four men actually returned to the massage parlor to give Shirley aid. At this point, our unknown subject emerged from the massage parlor with a rifle. I wasn't able to determine what kind of rifle he had, but he did shoot two of the four men as they were running towards him. These guys didn't sustain life-threatening injuries, which leads me to believe it probably wasn't like a 308 or 30-06 or 300 Magnum or something like that. It was probably a 22 or smaller caliber rifle. So this monster who attacked Shirley and her coworker was able to get into his red and white 1956 to 1958 Ford stepside pickup truck, and he got away. In the newspaper article that I found about this, I noticed that the truck was mentioned as having out-of-state plates, so not Oregon plates, but it doesn't say what state they were from, which is sorely lacking in information, in my opinion. Maybe the witnesses didn't recognize what state it was, which leads me to believe that it probably wasn't California, Idaho, or Washington. Maybe it was out of state from somewhere else in the country. I mean, there's, you know, 50 states. So if it wasn't one of the neighboring states, that leaves a lot of possibilities. Heck, it could even have been Canada for all we know. Those evil Canadians. And this is another case that 45 years later is probably going to go unsolved. In looking at the police sketch of this guy, this monster who attacked Shirley and killed her, he looks very thin of build. He looks like a kid, you know? He looks like he's 20 to 24 years old, not really a tough guy, hence the necessity that he attack women and that he use a rifle when men confront him. You know, he probably couldn't fight his way out of a paper bag. One thing that I'm thinking is that the kind of guy who would do this, obviously, is going to commit other crimes. So I can only hope that he committed other crimes. I don't hope he committed other crimes, but he probably did. I can only hope that when he committed other crimes, he was caught and incarcerated, hopefully for the rest of his life, rest of his short, pathetic life, and that he couldn't hurt anybody else after that. Because he certainly isn't going to be caught and convicted for this crime, not in my opinion. I mean, this is one of those crimes that would have been solved, could have been solved had it happened today. You know, these businesses, this massage parlor probably would have had surveillance video. The bar, the neighboring area probably would have had surveillance video. And they have license plate readers and all that kind of stuff now. So don't forget, you're always under surveillance. But if you had out-of-state plates, you know, they probably would have been easy to track down this flashy stepside red and white pickup truck. It probably would have been seen on, you know, traffic cameras, and probably would have had a better sketch today. We would have had, well, not just a sketch, but we probably would have had actual photos of this guy. And we have the internet, we have shows like America's Most Wanted, we have, you know, cable news. His image would have been plastered across the news, and somebody would have recognized him. And the fact that he was driving a truck from out of state, out of the area, you know, if they're asking witnesses and, you know, putting his picture in the newspaper locally, yeah, he's probably not going to get recognized because he probably came from somewhere far away to commit this crime. And what I'm trying to say here is, you know, today we can solve crimes if we have the resources. And even today, most crimes go unsolved. Even most murders go unsolved because they just don't have the resources. And as soon as the police get a case like this, and they can't solve it within the first 48 hours, like on that show, they have another murder that pops up, and they have to keep spreading their resources thinner and thinner and thinner, thus making it harder and harder to solve any of these crimes. So murder today is still kind of easy to get away with, even with all this surveillance, even with all of, you know, social media and nationwide media and instantaneous gratification where you can click on these things and spread these articles on Facebook and other platforms. A lot of murders still go unsolved. Heck, most crimes go unsolved. I know personally, when I've reported crimes, the police tell me this isn't going to get solved. Turn it over to the insurance company. This isn't going to get solved. You know, there's nothing you can do about it, basically. That's the message I've gotten, and that's the message that millions of Americans get every single day from their law enforcement professionals when they report a crime. And it's just because it's not that the cops don't want to solve these, it's that their resources are so thin, and there's going to be another crime happening in the next day or two, heck, in the next 5 minutes to half an hour. And they're just overwhelmed. We don't have the resources to track down and prosecute all of these criminals. Ah, such is life, you know. I can only hope that there's some karma out there and that this guy got what's coming to him one way or the other. Next, we have a case that actually does have a pretty good chance of being solved in that it happened relatively recently. On October 2nd, 2005, a woman named Angela Wilson was found dead in the Willamette River near the Jasper Bridge. And she was suffering from homelessness at the time of her death. She had become addicted to drugs and she was suffering from mental health problems. Angela was well known to law enforcement and well known in the homeless community in and around Eugene. She lived at a tent camp somewhere near the Jasper Bridge. And when I'm up in Eugene, I'm going to go over to where this bridge is and I'm going to walk around. I'm going to take some video. And I bet there's homeless people still living there. I mean, it's only been 16 years, not even quite 16 years since her murder. And these areas, we have a couple of them right here in Jackson County where there's a bridge, a waterway, and a tent city. And police do patrol them. And I know that part of the attitude of law enforcement is to keep the homeless people all living in the same kind of little tent city ghetto because the attitude is contain the problem. Again, they don't have the resources to be spread thin their resources are so spread thin that if the homeless people weren't corralled into one little area, one little tent city covered in feces and garbage, then the police wouldn't have enough, you know, manpower to patrol all of the homeless camps around. So the attitude is, you know, contain and let them do their thing. Keep them away from our public parks. Keep them away from neighborhoods where taxpayers live. And basically just kind of let them do drugs and victimize each other. And the likelihood is that Angela's killer is probably another homeless person. And they took advantage of her, or it could be a serial killer or other predator. But whoever it was most likely a man. She doesn't mention if she was sexually assaulted, but I'm pretty sure she was. I don't have the police report in front of me, but she was brutally beaten to death. And that's usually a man. I don't think a woman did this. And they took advantage of somebody who was mentally ill, who had, you know, had some family around, but had kind of written her off. And she was easy pickings. And we see this over and over and over again with marginalized communities where women who are addicted to drugs, engaged in prostitution and other risky activities, they're the favorite prey of the predator because chances are the thin, limited resources that are available aren't going to be spent on these women. You know, nobody cares if some homeless woman gets murdered. I mean, I shouldn't say nobody cares, but the public doesn't care as much as if it's a soccer mom or, you know, a local lawyer or, you know, a pretty young college student. That's where the resources get spent. They don't get spent on these women who are just as valid of human beings as anybody else. And they become victims. And, you know, just, I'm going to say it. You know what? Nobody cares. Society doesn't fucking care. It's bullshit. And we could do something about it, but we're not doing something about it as a society. I don't have all the answers, but gosh, I'm just thinking there's probably another woman in Oregon right now who's suffering the same abuse, who's probably going to become the same kind of victim. These murders don't stop. You know, homeless women are going to be murdered over and over and over, and we're probably not going to do anything about it. I'm going to get off my soapbox on this one. It kind of makes me angry. If you have any information about Angela's murder, you can call the Lane County Cold Case Unit at 541-682-4513. And her case number is 05-9003. And it's sad to say that her life is reduced to a case number. There are currently 156 outstanding missing persons in Lane County. This information I obtained from the state of Oregon's website where they list all the missing people from all of the counties in Oregon. And when I start Googling some of these people's names, sometimes they have information up on the Charlie Project, and sometimes there's literally nothing out there. So there's no resources being spent on trying to find these people. And they have been missing sometimes for decades and sometimes for months. And when I'm looking over this list, I'm struck by the amount of older teenagers who go missing, many of them young women. And here's one in particular, a Leslie Candelaria Amaya, went missing when she was 17, and she was last seen on June 22nd, 2019. I was able to find her Pinterest, her Facebook page, all of that kind of stuff. And she's a very pretty young girl, and I'm thinking she may be the victim of human trafficking. And this is one of those subjects that we don't talk about that much in our society, but there is a lot of rape, slavery, human trafficking, pimping, kidnapping, all of that kind of stuff. And oftentimes, young women and young boys are kidnapped. They are either taken by force or they are, you know, controlled by a criminal mastermind type who basically exerts psychological control over them and forces them into rape, slavery, or into, you know, selling drugs. God, just the possibilities are, they're endless and they're horrible. And I'm not saying that's what happened to her, but there's a lot of missing people out there that have, you know, that haven't been missing that long, and they are what we call endangered youth. And if you're driving up and down the I-5 and you stop at the rest stops between California and Oregon and up into Washington, and you go and look at those billboards, there are usually glass cases over by the bathroom, and they usually have information such as maps, and they'll show you the route you're on. They'll show you nearby parks and all kinds of good stuff. But then there'll usually be an entire case that is full of photographs of missing at-risk youth and sometimes other missing people. And the idea is if they put them at rest stops, people don't really have that much to do. You know, they're going to the bathroom, they stop to look at the maps, they stop to look at what's in the area, and they notice the missing people. And if they are victims of human trafficking, maybe they're being moved about using the highway interstate system. And maybe you're at the rest stop and maybe you recognize one of these at-risk youths being moved from place to place at the rest stop. You never know. Another missing person that caught my attention is a man named Aaron Barnes. Went missing when he was 41 years old, my current age. He would be 40 today. He was last seen in and around a homeless camp near Eugene on, actually in Florence, not in Eugene, on September 15th, 2019. And he's another who lived a very risky, you know, kind of lifestyle in a tent. And he hasn't been heard from his family. And the reason he caught my attention was I Googled him and I couldn't find a Charlie report or any type of information on him, but I did find another man by the same name, Aaron Barnes, who was murdered in a sex dungeon. And then when they arrested his murderer, who actually the pictures of him, he's wearing one of those leather outfits, and Aaron is pictured with a ball gag and a gimp mask on in these photos. So anyway, that caught my attention. I'm like, holy cow, this other guy was a murder victim with the same name. I mean, not that Aaron Barnes is a terribly common or uncommon name. But that's all I could find trying to figure out, our local missing person. Couldn't find anything, found a case from England with some pretty, eye-catching photographs. So as I'm trying to gather information about some of these missing people, I keep looking on Facebook, I keep looking on the internet, basically just searching. And a lot of these people are transients. They maybe are mixed up in drugs. I can usually find more mugshots than I can find news stories about these missing people. And I guess what I'm getting at here is if you don't want to wind up missing, try not to live a lifestyle that puts you on the margin of society where people aren't looking for you, or possibly they're glad you're gone because you were ripping off their shit or you were high on drugs. Try to live a reasonably upstanding lifestyle and, keep your head on a swivel. Don't put yourself in situations where you could become a victim. This is especially important. We always think about, the woman on the jogging path that gets attacked, or the little old lady who lives at home alone who gets attacked, walking in a dark parking garage at night when no one's around, carrying large sums of money, maybe making a bank run. Maybe you work retail and at the end of the night, you've got to go make a deposit. That used to be my life. I ran a couple of retail stores in another lifetime. and I was the general manager. And at the end of the night, I would have to take sometimes many thousands of dollars and go and deposit it at a Dropbox, sometimes at 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Pretty risky, but it was something I was required to do as part of my job. And as we know, it's almost impossible, at least when I lived in California, it was impossible to get a concealed carry permit. And most jobs don't want you having a firearm at work. So this puts you especially at risk because you cannot defend yourself. And as we know, there are very limited resources. The police are not everywhere all the time. In fact, there's never a cop when you need one, and there's always a cop when you don't want one to be there, like you're speeding or doing something like that. Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to get at here is we all have to take risk in our lives, but we don't have to take unnecessary risk. And, you know, I have taken many unnecessary risks in my own life, and I have put my own life in danger a number of times, things that I am not going to talk about on the podcast. And I am pretty straight-laced now, but, you know, I have lived a somewhat risky lifestyle in the past. Some of you who know me personally kind of know what I'm talking about. I've never been homeless. I've never been out there, you know, shooting meth or anything like that. I've never been involved in major criminal activity, but I have hung out with lots of homeless people. You know, once upon a time, I was known to hang out in the park and drink a bunch of beer with homeless people and have a barbecue, and they were my friends, and I got to know them pretty well, actually really well. So I've got lots of insights into the homeless community and, you know, what their goals and motivations are for remaining homeless. And a lot of them, it is a choice. It's not like they want to go and live in a house. But again, it's a choice. They're going to live a marginalized life. They're going to live a, you know, where they don't, they're going to live in such a way that they don't have a cell phone that they can keep charged to call for help. There's all kinds of things that we take for granted that can keep us safe. You know, if somebody is following us or we feel in danger, we could call for help. Lord knows if there's going to be resources available to respond instantly, you know, and, you know, like the FBI is going to come to your rescue as soon as you're abducted. That does happen, but that is not typically the case. If you become the victim of a crime, you're not going to be rescued. It's up to you to rescue yourself. And with that said, remember those four guys who went to rescue Shirley Wallace and try to give her help? Those kind of people are awesome. And if you ever see somebody who is in danger, being attacked, don't be a pussy, you know, especially if there's other people that you can gang up on that perpetrator, you know, don't be afraid to get involved. If it was me and I was being attacked, I'd like to think that people wouldn't just stand by and watch me be attacked. In that same vein, you know, if I see somebody who's being victimized, it's kind of my duty as a citizen to intervene in any way possible without, you know, getting myself killed. There are many famous cases where bystanders, people watched murders happen and didn't even call it in, didn't even report it. We could go over that, but I think you guys know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, just kind of Google it. There's a syndrome where everybody thinks that somebody else who's witnessing a crime is going to do something about it, or they're going to call it in. And that is not the case. If you want a response from the limited resources that law enforcement has to offer, it's up to you to make it happen. You know, one idea I had was that I was possibly going to sit here and read off the names of all 156 people who are currently missing out of Lane County. I think that would get a little old and get a little monotonous. And I don't think that's necessary, but I will tell you to go to Oregon.gov and then search in their missing person database for whatever county you're in. And you can read the list for yourself. I think I'm going to, you know, list a couple of names here that kind of strike me as, I'm going to try not to butcher them, but strike me as unique and, you know, pretty good names, right? Here is a Charlene Brown, not Charlie Brown, but Charlene Brown. And she was, she is 35, assuming she's still alive. And she's only been missing for a couple of months. She was last seen, basically a month ago. And, you know, we hope she's found. There's nothing out there if you search her name. There's a Destiny Gold Christian Sport. She's 26, and I did Google her and found a mugshot where she was arrested for you know, meth possession, and she's only been missing for a couple of months. We hope she's found. She's probably missing on her own accord. There's a Caden D'Ambrosio, who's 16, one of those missing at-risk youths that we were talking about that you can see missing posters of at the rest stops. There's a lot of really good names here. You know, I could go on all day long, but if you're interested, I hope, you know, no matter where you're listening from, that your county or your state or your country keeps a list of current missing people, especially in your area. And, you know, you maybe want to peruse it once in a while. You might even know somebody who's gone missing, but you weren't aware that they're missing. And maybe you even have a pertinent piece of information about that associate, that person, that neighbor, that old friend that you haven't seen in a while who's gone missing. And maybe you have a tip that could help out the cops and help out the family, you know, and maybe, you know, bring that person home. There's a Fawn Moon who's been missing since 1969, and she would be 102 today. And even though she's been missing since 1969, her missing persons report wasn't entered into the database until 10 years ago. So she would have been like 92, 93 years old when she was finally officially considered missing by the state of Oregon. What the heck was going on with that? Did she disappear? And everybody's like, you know, 50 years later, oh, we still haven't heard from Fawn. I actually see that pretty common where people go missing and they aren't reported missing for quite some time, sometimes decades. That just kind of makes you wonder, you know, if nobody's looking for you, nobody's looking for you. And I'll close with this. In my limited resources episode that I made last season, if you go missing, if one of your friends goes missing, if one of your family members goes missing, it's up to you to find them. It's up to you to organize the search efforts, to make phone calls, and to be on police's good side and to get them involved with the search. Gosh, I hope you don't go missing, and I hope you don't become a death mystery. And maybe you've learned something tonight by listening to my Lane County episode. It's a beautiful place. I always went to Lane County for the Mushroom Festival at the Pisgah Arboretum. Every single year on Halloween, they have this awesome Mushroom Festival there. And they've got hay rides. They've got beautiful mushroom display, lots of food, bands, all kinds of stuff, mushroom geeks galore. And that's kind of my favorite time to go up to the Eugene-Springfield area. We didn't have it last year because of this damn COVID. And I really hope we have it again this year, because I went to it for 4 or 5 years in a row and brought mushroom specimens, hung out and talked to my fellow mushroom geeks. So true crime, one of my loves, mushroom geeking, one of my real true loves. And thanks for listening. Be aware of your situation. Be aware of other people's situations. If you have a neighbor or a friend or a family member that you haven't seen in quite some time and you think they might be missing, you might be the only person who's noticed or cares enough to make that phone call and report them missing. So, with that said, it's pretty dark out. I got to go into my graveyard shift job. Thank you again for listening, and don't become a death mystery.